This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March 11th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this we're going to look at some of the key developments that took place this week, March the 11th, 2024. And some of those key developments we look at this week include FinCEN reacted to the court case we discussed last week. Is going to talk about what exactly they're doing about beneficial owner information enforcement following the National Small Business United versus Yellen decision that came down from the district court in Alabama on March 1st. We'll also talk about an IRS warning that was issued, warning taxpayers and employer plan administrators about companies peddling doctor's notes to attempt to convert personal expenses into either deductible medical expenses or realistically, amounts to be reimbursed from flexible spending accounts or potentially HRAs and HSAs. We'll talk a bit about that and how that works. Okay, all of our stuff going. So we'll be looking about that as well as a couple of other key issues. Let's start out with our first issue here. This is the FinCEN's announcement. It was a news release they put out on March 4th. Essentially the Monday following the decision that came down on the Friday before, and it's entitled Notice Regarding National Small Business United versus Yellen, number 5:22-CV-01448, the Northern District of Alabama. Again, it was a FinCEN news release. Now, in case you forgot what that whole case was about, that case held that the Corporate Transparency Act's beneficial ownership information reporting requirements were effectively unconstitutional. It was an exercise beyond what Congress is allowed to do under the United States Constitution, that it did not qualify under any of the enumerated powers. And for that reason, the court found that, in fact, the entire bill had to be thrown out and issued an order to that effect that barred FinCEN from essentially enforcing this against the plaintiffs. And so we're going to discuss kind of what that means because there's been some confusion there. The real thing that's of interest there and has been pointed out in a few articles is that the order itself only granted relief, only barred FinCEN from acting against the named plaintiffs. Now that's per the wording of the agreement. It didn't say they had to act against anybody else. It didn't even say that, this order, bars you or, doesn't apply to everybody else, but it never said it did. So the presumption being, and I think a lot of people for safety's purposes would assume, that having not said it applied to anybody else, it probably doesn't right now apply to anyone else. Again, the order was written, it was requested relief, the court granted that relief, and they didn't grant it nationwide or bar FinCEN from enforcing the law just in general. It's a very narrow decision. Now, there were articles in tax notes, especially one that came out or will come out officially on Monday, that discussed some back and forth on whether this actually would apply beyond simply members of the National Association of Small Business. Or if it, is that the way it would work? And certainly there was at least one attorney who was quoted as stating that there is at least some case law that suggests it should go beyond that. But that's not really a ringing, oh yeah, that's absolutely how it goes. And as I noted, a lot of people were going to be very concerned about, how far this would go. Well, Treasury makes it clear their position. FinCEN announced that they will apply a decision only to members of the National Association of Small Businesses as of March 1st, 2024. So if you are a member of that organization, you're protected from being, from having FinCEN come after you for violations of the BOI, at least until such time as they get the order overturned on appeal, right? The Supreme Court rules otherwise. So, whether that'll happen and how quickly that'll happen, well, that's a whole nother issue. The actual notice that was published, as I said, on the 4th of March basically tells us that it is going to be just those members of National Association of Small Businesses as of March 1st. That was the other question that some people were concerned about. Is it everybody, or is, you know, that's a member of that organization, so could you go sign up today and get protection? Or is it only the people that were members on the date the order was granted? And FinCEN is taking, not surprisingly, the narrower interpretation of saying it's only the people who are members on that date. They were the named plaintiffs. They are the people discussed about. And, you know, this court order is not meant to essentially open this up for everybody, you know, by simply sending in your check, sending in your dues, and becoming a member of the organization. Probably we'll have, you know, again, this is open to questions. I've certainly heard attorneys who think there may be an argument that it should apply to any member of the organization, even if they weren't a member on March 1st. There's been a little bit of similar issues that have risen, not in the area of FinCEN, but in other arenas, and where we haven't seen the government challenge when somebody asserts a protection under the organization. Then again, they haven't been challenging much of anything on the area in question, so it's kind of tough to tell what it means about this. So the practical problem we've got at this point then is, what are you doing? Because that's the question everybody has right now. Okay, we have this decision. It's come down. We understand it. You know, what in the world should we or our clients be doing? Well, you know, the actions for those who are impacted by this, potentially impacted by the decision, or impacted by the beneficial ownership information. FinCEN's announcement means that from a practical standpoint, unless you want a chance, you know, let's go ahead, let's be prosecuted, and let's see, or at least take the chance of being prosecuted, and then let's see if we can persuade a judge that that Alabama decision should have applied to us, or we can convince a judge the Alabama decision was simply right, and therefore FinCEN can act against us. Most people I know are not really looking out for trying to get into litigation, taking risks, especially at $591 per day for each day you're out of compliance. So bottom line, as a practical matter, probably means we're going to be looking at quasi-enforcement. Or I should say, basically continuing on with this. And even for those who are a member of the National Association of Small Businesses, you have to realize that if the case is appealed, there could be a stay of the ruling, which a district court could grant. Most likely they would grant it if they believe there is a high probability that the decision will be overturned. So you could see them stay the decision. That wouldn't be probably not a good sign. It doesn't automatically mean you're going to lose the case. But if they really think your case is super strong, then they would normally not grant relief to the other party to have a stay of the order pending the appeal. They think the most likely outcome by far is that the case will be sustained. Then they're not going to grant relief. And of course, conversely, if they believe that it is likely to be overturned, then they're more likely to grant the relief. So that's kind of how this works. But the problem is, even if they do grant the relief, it's still possible the district court, you know, they don't rule on the temporary hold, or just FinCEN doesn't ask for it. You still could find out late in the game, you know, late this year, it could be overturned, and your deadlines might not get extended at all. So again, it's a little bit risky, even if you're a member of the National Association of Small Business, get that outright, if you don't go ahead and just get these things done. So that's one of our problems in it. So generally, when I've read most articles I've read, most attorneys I've talked to are coming down on the side of counseling you to be, you know, continue to plan to have to comply with the law. And, you know, be aware, and if you're not horribly against compliance, right, you're not horribly against against providing this information, then you might consider complying a little bit, you know, just like you would have regardless of this case. The idea being that then you don't run the risk at the end of the year of not being able to find a professional to assist you if, in fact, the government succeeds in having this case overturned. Or, you know, you end up having to file because we don't know the answer by the end of the year, which is a very, very likely scenario. that we won't have an answer by the end of the year. So that'll also be in there. So as I said, most people are counseling those who are covered by this bill or by this law to go ahead and prepare to file, maybe even consider filing. Certainly, if you've established an LLC, you know, at the beginning of 2024, we're coming up on your 90 days. If you did it early in January, I'm going to come up on that here in a couple of weeks. You probably want to consider just filing. You know, just doing it by the 90th day. Don't take the risk. Obviously, as I would put it, if you're going to go the other way, you want to basically make sure you have your attorney who tells you it's fine to do so, totally behind you, absolutely sure this thing's going to be thrown out, and make sure you get it in writing. Yeah, most attorneys I know are saying, even if they think there's a reasonable chance this could succeed, that's not necessarily the majority opinion of those I've talked with, but even if you think it's going to succeed, you know, they'd still be leaning toward, yeah, but what if it doesn't? And their answer there would be to try to get the fix otherwise. So, you know, keep an eye on it. But compliance probably going to continue for the immediate future. If your client wants to hold off filing, okay, maybe. But as I would warn a client, if you hold off and you're going to want me to assist you, you can't come in here in December and suddenly tell me we want to do it. That's if you want to go that route, you better talk to me right now and put a deposit down is what I'd frankly say, because, you know, I'm not going to be able to take everybody in December, you know, for those that I would be comfortable filing. And there's also a chance that I'm going to discover after we get into your stuff and look at a little bit that I'm not even comfortable doing yours and that you need to go find legal counsel. Again, if we're on the deadline, that's going to be tougher and tougher to do. So, as I say, be careful and keep an eye on all of this. Next up, the IRS this week issued a news alert warning about companies that are out there offering doctor's letters to attempt to create a deductible general wellness expense, which then the individual could turn over to the administrator of an FSA, an HSA, or an HRA, you know, turn over and claim, this proves that I have a legitimate medical expense for these items. Now, what the IRS is warning about here is they are warning both taxpayers and administrators of employer plans, because it works for either. But the concept here is these companies are going to claim that if you get a note from a doctor on a self-reported health information, these doctors don't see the individuals. They don't themselves do any sort of diagnosis. They just simply write a letter and state, exercise would be great for you. You know, exercise would be great for your, you know, for whatever you tell me you've got. Or maybe these foods would be great. You should be on a, you know, kind of a special diet. You know, you should be on this sort of diet. So you want to make sure you buy foods like this. And then they write a doctor's note. So various things of that sort. And then the individuals will then submit when they go to the grocery store and they buy the food, they would then attempt to get reimbursed from the FSA, or take it from their HSA or submit it for a health reimbursement arrangement with the employer. IRS says, guys, wait, this doesn't really work. Under Section 213 of the Internal Revenue Code, to be a medical expense, it has to be a targeted diagnosis-specific activity or treatment for a specific, you know, disease or function of the body, and not just a general wellness option. And many of these are looking at converting general wellness options, and especially having doctors that really don't see you, right? They've never had a diagnosis in the chart. They're not going to have one because they don't want the liability for having misdiagnosed you, especially since they didn't do anything except take your letter stating that, I've got this, I'm diabetic or I'm whatever, you know. And well, you may be, you know, the reality is that nope, the doctor needs to give you, you know, basically be involved, have a targeted diagnosis, and then make a specific recommendation based on that diagnosis for the treatment program in general. There are also other restrictions, generally for things like food. If it replaces the nutrition you otherwise would need, only in limited cases can you get the additional cost of special food, but not the full cost, right? So it's a marginal cost differential at best. There's a lot of things that get us into trouble there. But these outfits are out there selling the doctor's notes. Apparently, they've got some physicians who are willing to sit there and write these notes and telling you it'd be good for you to go, you know, join a gym or whatever, get exercise programs. That doesn't qualify you for a deduction, nor does it qualify you for reimbursement from your employer's plan. Finally, we're going to take a look at the case of Scott v. Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2024-27. This case came down on March the 7th. And what this case deals with is the taxpayer had been a civilian employee of the Department of Defense. And as such, they were disabled while they were on the job. So they receive a disability pension from the Civil Service Administration, Civil Service Retirement. Now, they had argued that this disability payment was excludable under Section 104A4 of the Internal Revenue Code. 104, you're probably aware, has a lot of special rules about, you know, certain awards or payments being excludable from income if related to injuries. It's what excludes workers' comp payments from income. It's what excludes certain awards from people for injuring you or whatever they did cause certain disease. You can get that excluded. All of those sorts of things are in there, but a special one here is 104A4. And that exclusion is limited to a pension payment for personal injury or illness, but it must be attributable to very specific types of services and with specific governmental agencies. And those agencies in this case are active service in the armed forces, right? The Coast Guard and Geodetic Survey, or the Public Health Service. And the way this works is that essentially it also excludes, I should say, a payment under Section 808 of the Foreign Services Act. And this looks to, if you're receiving your payments, your pension, and it related to active service in those, you know, those pensions or your disability that related to illness or disability related to work with active service in the armed forces, then it would be excludable. Now, the problem here was that this individual was a civilian employee of the Department of Defense, was not a member of the armed services per se. They worked in a civilian position. And as such, as the court points out, that's not going to work, right? It's not anybody who is employed by the government and gets a civil service payment for disability does not qualify for this. It is only these very specific jobs and agencies that work. And hey, guys, this doesn't work. Now, the court's unhappy here because this same taxpayer had been in a prior year raising the same issue. And the court had pointed all of this out in the prior case, right? They did not meet these requirements. It wasn't active service in the military. So that's the big problem. You know, the taxpayer had lost in a prior tax court case under the same exact facts. And the court now is a little bit upset with them. They specifically warned the taxpayer that continuing to raise these issues may result in a penalty of up to $25,000 under Internal Revenue Code Section 6673A. That provision talks about essentially certain sanctions that can be applied by the United States Tax Court. And the court's saying you're wasting our time effectively by bringing back here exactly the same facts you brought in before and which you lost on before. You are trying to again try the same facts. There is no material difference here. We're not going to change our result. Only if you can come back with a material difference, or at least a materially different argument about why you should, you know, get this benefit, then yeah, we're probably not going to pay a lot of attention to you. So it could get expensive. Now, to close out this week, I did want to talk briefly about the status of the bill that could potentially retroactively change the tax law. Probably the big thing there is retroactively open up Section 174 expensing for both 22 and 23, along with giving us bonus depreciation for last year and, you know, working up a few other things that are helpful for us, right? You know, we get back 163J, so we have a, you know, the same computation we had before. We had to then reduce the income by the depreciation, amortization, and depletion, which means that your deductible interest, since it's a percent of that ATI number, went down. So all of those would be in that bill, which passed overwhelmingly in the House at the end of January. Nevertheless, we're sitting here now heading to the middle of March, and it's still not moved. Well, where do we stand right now? Right now, it appears we are waiting for the Republican members, at least of the basically Senate Finance Committee, and the chair, or I should say the ranking member of the committee, has stated that he's looking for getting something out there that at least half of the Republicans in the Senate can get behind, and then talk about whether or not they can make that change, right? They'll have to then open it up. Obviously, if the Republicans are going to ask for change, don't be surprised the Democrats ask for change. And the issue, the big issue that Mike Crapo is, you know, Senator Crapo is really concerned about, is cost about $1 billion, which isn't huge, but it does mean that probably on the other side, you'd have to find some way to give up $1 billion of the what you'd otherwise get with these changes we're going to make to the business rules. So interesting mess, because the change would be the child tax credit he's looking for. And then you also have to assume, as they're pointing out, complicating this is, while it did pass overwhelmingly in the House, there's still a real question about how much you can make in way of changes and still have the House voted out. Because, you know, if you're going to insist that we have to have this special change, but nobody's going to vote for the bill with that change in, then, yeah, that's not going to do much good anyway. So we'll have to see what happens going forward there. The chair of Senate Finance did say his goal was to pass something by April 15th, but he's now admitted that if that goal isn't met, it won't end the bill. So we may be looking well beyond April 15th to get this fixed. Again, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 11th, 2024. Current Federal Tax Developments brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. As always, I do check in. If you want to email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I'll try to answer you there. It's a little wild this time of year because it's tax season, but we'll do what we can. I also monitor some of the discussion boards, the Connect boards for the Arizona Society, the New Jersey Society. Take a look at Illinois, Minnesota, and Washington, as well as look into some discussions on Idaho's discussion board. So you can check in there. If you're a member of one of those state societies, you can post the questions there. And if I see it and I think I can help, I may go ahead and answer there as well. Otherwise, we're going to see you back here next week, looking for whatever else ends up coming up under the federal law. And we'll deal with the current federal tax developments for what will be the week of just after St. Patrick's Day. So join us back next week for that one.